Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted to be joined by Isabel Vincent, a Canadian investigative journalist who writes for the New York Post. Her latest book, Dinner with Edward, details her friendship with an elderly man in New York whose wife had recently died and who found solace in sharing his culinary secrets with her. Isabel, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Isabel, we're going to begin where we always do, childhood food. You grew up in Toronto.
Correct.
Can you tell us about what food looked like for you when you were young?
So I grew up in an immigrant household in Toronto. Both my parents were from Portugal. So we spoke Portuguese at home. And I grew up with bacalhau, which is salted cod. And this was, you know, we had it every week. And there's like a million ways to make salted cod. So you can just boil it with potatoes or you can like do all sorts of crazy things. But, you know, the three basic ingredients are potatoes, olive oil, and cod. And I have to tell you a funny story that's not from my childhood, but when I first became a correspondent in Brazil, I was a bureau chief for the Globe and Mail in Latin America for a number of years. And so my first Christmas there, I'm having Christmas dinner with a friend of mine who is a writer and whose agent in Barcelona every Christmas sent out salted cod, because it's such a delicacy and it's hard to get in Brazil, to all of her writers in Latin America. And among the writers, she had political friends, and among those friends was Fidel Castro. So that year, we got Fidel Castro's package of cod, which we ate for Christmas dinner. Wow. And I've wondered, you know, what's he having?
And was it hard to get hold of in Toronto in
no,
your childhood?
No, because there was such a big Portuguese community.
Right.
So, I mean, and cod is from northern Canada and Norway. So it actually comes from there and it actually has to go to Portugal.
Right.
So we were at the epicenter.
Perfect. Mm. I mean, if you come to it late in life, it can be quite an acquired taste. As a child, did you like it from the get-go or was it something you grew to enjoy?
I mean, I had no choice, right? Because like it was considered like the brain food in the way that people give you cod liver oil. Like we had cod like as porridge, if you can imagine that, with sort of stale bread and olive oil in the morning. Like this is what I grew up with.
That's power food. Yeah, that's real power
like,
food.
It's omega. It's, yeah. You know, so this is it. You know, that's the one thing. And I love it, you know, and it's interesting. My daughter and my nephews, who all grew up with it, but in a different generation, obviously, they love it too. And they don't get it as often as they can, because they're all over the place. But I actually go to New Jersey to buy, because there's a big Portuguese community there, so I take the train and I go and buy it and bring it back. I mean, my friends think it's ridiculous, but it's like one of those foods that just, you know, is very important to me.
Mm. And did you learn to cook when you were younger?
You know, I did, but nothing like I'm cooking now. I mean, I'm going a bit crazy. I'm milling my own flour now and making sourdough. And I have my, you know, I have my levain that I kind of carry around with me.
Baby.
Yeah. So,
and caring for.
And I'm just, you know, and I think it's really because of, you know, dinner with Edward. I mean, not that he did all of those things, but once I started down that road of, you know, great ingredients and cooking all the time, I just went to the extreme. I mean, I'm not that crazy, but and the milling of the flour is not that hard. I mean, you just buy the wheat berries and you put it in a, you know, a little machine and it does it. But there's nothing quite like the taste of freshly milled flour when you're making bread.
Mm. And when mealtimes, obviously, and we'll come to it in a moment, the meals that you have with Edward are almost ritualistic. Were mealtimes a big deal when you were growing up? Did
yes.
you all sit down as a family together?
Yes, for dinner we all sat down together and everybody had like assigned seats. So, I mean, it was me and my brother and my mom and dad, but everybody had a place to sit, and there was always wine. Like, from a very early age, we had it mixed with 7-Up, which is, or I don't even know. Do you have 7-Up?
We do. Okay. We are familiar. Don't worry. We're familiar with 7-Up. An import.
And it was really, I think it was so awful that I didn't want to ever have wine. Like,
I mean,
it's
a real way to put children off wine.
Oh, it really is. Maybe that's what they were trying to do, but I don't think so. And, you know, my dad is 91 now, and he has a glass of red wine with every meal. So in terms of ritualistic, it was an important meal for us. Dinner was an important meal for us.
Yeah.
And you became a reporter for a Canadian newspaper. What was the diet like of a kind of young cub reporter at that stage?
So, you know, I cooked, but it was a lot of pizza on Fridays. And, you know, I look back and think that's not so great. And a lot of bad food because, I mean, I tried to do things, but it was a lot of pasta and stuff that was easy to make. So I have no great memories of food when I became a young reporter. Because I was just so obsessed with, you know, trying to get ahead. But when I moved to Brazil, I became a correspondent at an early age. I was 25. And so when I went to live there, I suddenly inherited this, you know, a housekeeper and a cook. And so they made the most amazing food. And it was always, you know, rice and beans with every meal and farofa, which is the ground up manioc flour, which, you know, I came to love. Mm-hmm. And so that changed radically when I went on my first sort of major assignment.
And you met Edward, it's about a decade ago that you met him?
So 2000 and maybe 10.
Okay.
Yeah.
So before you met him, and he's obviously hugely influential in the food that you ate during your friendship and presumably afterwards. What did your food life look like before your friendship with him?
So again, I was cooking. I was cooking at home, but I was so overwhelmed with this new job I had at the New York Post because it was like the hardest job in journalism I'd ever done.
Really,
I mean, it was like investigative. You were suddenly competing against the Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Daily News, and you could not have anything they had. And you had to have something original every week, which I thought, I can't do this, but somehow I did. I've been doing it for 11 years. But so, you know, there wasn't a lot of emphasis on what we're eating, but I was still going to New Jersey to get salted cod. Mm. I was still buying squid and, you know, trying to make, like, rather unsuccessfully, I might add, squid, you know, grilled squid on my stove and things like that. So I was trying to eat well, and I was trying to bring that Portuguese influence to also for my daughter, you know, who was young at the time. But, you know, she'd grown up with that, partly in Toronto from her grandmother. So I was trying to do that, but maybe not as consistently as I would have liked to.
And do you find a comfort in the Portuguese food of your childhood, or is it more about passing on the inheritance?
Oh, no, it's a comfort.
Yeah.
And I love it, you know, and I, you know, I'm thrilled to see in London that there are all these little pastry shops selling the Portuguese, the custard tarts, the pastéis nata. Mm. Like, those are, you know, from my childhood.
Do you know how to make those?
Oh, no, I would never try. Like, the flakiness of that pastry. And you know the origin of that, right? It's it comes from the monasteries in Portugal. The nuns at the monasteries used to use all the egg whites to starch the robes of the priests. So they would have all this yolk left over, and that's where the custard tart starts, because they use the yolk and the sugar and that, and they just went crazy. So that has like a religious connotation, but they are so good.
They really are.
So you're living in New York, you're working at the New York Post. How was it that you came into the orbit of Edward?
So Edward is the father of a good friend of mine who lives in Canada. And I actually worked for her in Canada. She was she used to have a children's publishing company, and I was an intern for her when I was 18. And she actually, it's a funny story, it's in the book. When she hired me, she gave me a typing test, and these are the days of IBM Selectrix, and they put me in a room with a typewriter. And I think I spent 45 minutes with the typewriter, and then I came out sheepishly and said, how do you turn this on? And they said, you're hired. So Valerie, Edward's daughter, when her mother died, so Edward had been married 69 years, and when his wife died, he wanted to die, and he checked himself into Lenox Hill Hospital, and she came to New York, and at that time, I had just moved to New York, and we had dinner. It was Christmas Eve. And, you know, she said, I'm really worried about him, because Valerie's from New York, I should mention. And could you look in on him and maybe have dinner with him? And I'm like, okay. And she said, he's a really good cook. I'm like, right. So I went to see him, and we're both living on Roosevelt Island, which is an odd place in New York. It's in Manhattan, but it's in the middle of the East River. I mean, it's fairly easy to get to, but it is the site of historically... It was the Rikers Island of its day. So it's all of the jails were there, the lunatic asylum, which I happened to be living in, like the converted lunatic asylum. So I found myself living a couple of blocks from Edward, and I went to have dinner with him, and I was like blown away. Because not only the food was brilliant, and he's a self-taught cook, he taught himself to cook in his 70s, but... You know, the whole atmosphere, it was like this fantasy of New York where we're sitting in his apartment overlooking the Upper East Side and the UN and the Queensboro Bridge. So you've got this fantastic view. And then he's got Ella Fitzgerald or Billie Holiday on, you know, his CD player. And he's giving you a martini.
A perfect martini.
And, you know, he had a secret to his martini where he would, I mean, he would just like chill everything in the freezer beforehand, but he had a way of doing it where he used lemon zest and he infused the gin, and it was only Hendrix gin, with the lemon zest, and then added the vermouth. And it was just like, it was so great. But he chilled the glasses. I mean, this is a man who warmed his plates in the oven before he served dinner. Like, sometimes I would arrive and say, hey, what's for dinner? And he said, oysters Rockefeller. And I would say, well, what's the occasion? And he would look at me sort of, you know, with a twinkle in his eye and say, do we need one? And that sort of embodies or encapsulates what those dinners were all about. It's that you didn't need an occasion because you were together. And, you know, he could have served anything and it would have been memorable. And so that's, you know, that really taught me to sort of take your time around the dinner table or at any meal and just value the person that you're with. And one of the great things about Edward were the stories he told at dinner. I mean, he was kind of Scheherazade, you know, with all of these stories. And they were just about ordinary people that he'd, you know, met at the butcher shop or that he'd shared a hospital room with. And they all became characters in his life. So it was more than just food. It was everything else that came with it.
And you say he was self-taught, but you also mentioned in the book that he doesn't really follow recipes. I mean, where did he discover food?
I mean, this is a guy who built all of his furniture and who could look at things and sort of duplicate them. He once looked at an almond cake at, you know, a very fancy pastry shop in New York and, you know, duplicated it perfectly. I think he just had an eye for things and he had a feel for things. And sure, he read, you know, he would go to the library and read the New York Times and read the food section. And I'm sure he took stuff from there. But, you know, there was just this constant, like a lot of it was common sense. And he'd also grown up in the South and spent time with, I mean, he was poor, but he spent time with a rich uncle in New Orleans. And so went to all of these great restaurants in the 1920s and 30s. And I think by osmosis just, you know, took things away from that. But it's interesting because, you know, he had this thing where he very reluctantly gave out recipes.
It's one of my favorite things in the book.
Like, and this woman came to dinner and said, oh, the chicken pie art is so great. Can I have the recipe? And he told me, I'm not giving her the recipe. And I said, why? And he said, well, I could tell she's not devoted. and, you know, to cook, you need to be devoted. So he never gave her the recipe.
But he gave you a lot of his recipes. He clearly recognized in you that devotion that he required to the food.
Yeah, and he'd write them out longhand and he'd mail them to me. But his recipes were kind of crazy. It was like you just had to, instinctively know what they meant, like 2 times ice cubes in pastry crushed, you know. So it wasn't like there were very precise measurements all the time, but, you know, somehow I was able to muddle through it. And some of the things I made didn't turn out, but the more I've made them, the better I got at them. I've made a lot of his apple galettes, and then I've experimented and done peach galettes with rosemary and, you know, so all sorts of things.
He made amazing soufflés, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the description of the soufflés.
The apricot soufflés were absolutely brilliant.
And have you managed to replicate those?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I'm sorry I'm bragging here, but...
No.
But, you know, I tried it with, you know, I tried to cut corners with that, like I'm admitting this, and I used fresh apricots, but he specifically says use dried apricots, and, you know, you have to boil them essentially and then leave them for kind of half a day. And then you put them in a food processor. And I thought, oh no, well, I'll just do it this other way. And it just doesn't work.
No.
So you have to follow his instructions when he does give you instructions to follow.
And your meals with Edward coincide with the breakdown of your marriage. Did you find solace in dining with him?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, I had this like very bleak situation at home, and then I'd go there, and it was like the best time of, it was the worst time of my life, but it was also the best time of my life. And I would just come out of those dinners so happy. I mean, I felt like I was in some kind of film about New York. Like, I know nobody wants to talk about Woody Allen now, but as a kid, I saw a lot of his films and, you know, this kind of fantasy of Manhattan. And that's what I was living. I mean, not the relationship part, but the city, the greatness of the city, and the possibility of where I was, because, you know, I'd wanted to come to New York, I'd wanted to work in New York for a long time, but I didn't imagine that it was going to be, you know, that everything around me was going to break apart, and that's what happened. But meeting Edward sort of, you know, reinvigorated that dream, if I could say it that way. Like, it was just so positive.
Tell us about that very first dinner that you had with him. What did he cook after the perfect martini?
So I think the first dinner was a chicken paillard. I'm not sure that I started with the first dinner in the book. I started with a dinner, but it was a chicken paillard, and it was his crazy French fries, which were very complicated to make. I mean, they were... The potatoes were parboiled, and then they were fried, and then they were frozen. So it was obviously this very long process, and then they were fried again. Mm-hmm. And they were just sublime. And then he used goose fat to fry them as well. And it was just, they were just so wonderful.
And what do you think the secret is to a good dinner party?
So a couple of things. The ingredients. I mean, this was a man who went all over Manhattan and Queens to find his ingredients as a 90-year-old with a cane, which was always like very moving to me that he did that. Like, if he made a cassoulet, he would go to Chinatown to get the duck at a particular place. He had a French épicerie where he bought the sausage. It was almost artistic, everything he put into the meal. So the food was spectacular, but also the people. And I mean, often it was just the two of us, but there were a couple of dinners where he did invite other people. And he, again, these are the people he met in his elevator, but they were like, you know, the refugees who had just come from Albania, or the Czech artist who was living in his building, and then the dentist from Long Island. Like, these were the sort of an eclectic mix of people that you would maybe never meet anywhere else. And the conversation, you know, sometimes it would be just the two of us, and he would, you know, read some of the poetry that he'd written to his wife after she died. And those were like really intense evenings.
So intimate.
But, yeah. I don't know that he'd read the poetry to other people. He wanted to have those poems published. And I remember he wrote to the poetry magazines in the United States, and he sent off his poems, you know, hoping that they never got published. But I just love that he continued to do that, you know, as a 94-year-old.
It's incredible. And the precision that he showed in his cooking also went as far as the alcohol pairing. He would never serve the wine that you brought with you as a host gift, right?
Right. He would put it in his makeshift cellar in his coat closet, and because he had already chosen the wines for the meal, which, you know, I don't want to make him sound like he's some kind of snob. I mean, he was a snob about certain things, like, you know, about the gin. I mean, he only used Hendrick's gin, but then he would also happily go to the local supermarket and buy a steak and just make it spectacular by marinating it in balsamic vinegar. Mm. And I didn't know these tricks. Like, I didn't know the trick with the pasta, you know, after the pasta's cooked, to coat it in balsamic vinegar so that the sauce will cling to it. I mean, these are all things that I learned just by watching him.
And your book ends with Edward still alive, but in the postscript it mentions that he died. I mean, did he get a chance to read the book, or was he aware of the book?
Yes, he did. So, and he read the book literally when he was, like, on his deathbed, if I could use that phrase. And I always thought that he, like, I told him I was writing this, but I don't think he took me seriously. So I gave him the manuscript, and he was very grateful. And I remember that one of the last meals, both of his daughters were there, and he had been in, you know, he'd been sick for a number of weeks, and he hadn't come out to dinner. But that day, when I came with the manuscript, he came to dinner and sat at the table. And the one gesture of gratitude that, you know, I'll never forget is, like, with his cane and his walker, he stood up from his chair with great difficulty, and he took out my chair so that I could sit. And that was just, you know, like, I understood that as, like, he can barely move now, but this was, you know, how grateful he was that I had done this. And then he wrote me a letter that was sort of dated 3 a.m. I guess he was awake, and he'd read the manuscript. This was a couple of days later. And he said, you know, he was very grateful, but who was going to read this? Because he's not a celebrity, and I'm not a celebrity, and who cares? And, you know, it's nice that people care. I think that it's because he wasn't a celebrity, that he was a very ordinary, extraordinary man who had all these dreams when he came to New York of becoming an actor, but were never realized, and worked in a factory, but did all these things in life just to enrich his life and enrich the lives of people around him. And I really think that should be celebrated.
He clearly taught you a huge amount about food, but if you were to sum up what he taught you about things apart from food, about life, because that's a huge message of the book, how would you describe it?
So one of the great things he was always trying to instill in me, that he said I should also instill in my daughter, is about women taking charge of their lives. Because he'd seen so much tragedy in his own family where, you know, his, and just, you know, just because of the years we're talking about, the 30s and the 40s, where women in the South didn't have so much power. Like, one of his sisters ends up getting pregnant from one of her professors. He dumps her. So, you know, the family has to raise the child, which is fine. You know, they were happy to do that. But he said, women shouldn't be treated like that. And you have to be self-assured. You have to, you know, you have to empower your daughter. So this was the big message that, and you know, when I asked him, why did you fall in love with your wife? Because this was, like, you know, this crazy love story, like, over 69 years. He had a picture of her. He had the same picture duplicated in different rooms of his house so that he could, you know, look at her when he was cooking and look at her when he was reading. But I said, what was it about your wife? And he said, it was her self-assurance. Mm. And that's what made me fall in love with her.
Isabel, thank you so much for joining us on Table Talk. Isabel Vincent's book, Dinner with Edward, is available now, and the film starring David Suchet is in production. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please do rate, review and subscribe on your podcast provider. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.